Hey guys, Nick here.
Alex too. And we're just here to quickly say that November 3rd is fast approaching. It feels like every election that there's a group of people more famous than us sending out endless reminders to vote in, quote, the most important election of our lifetime. But I think it's safe to say this year certainly qualifies as one of the most significant in American history.
That's why we're including a bunch of links in today's episode, for where to find your local polling station and how to get there. Plus, how to navigate around the confusing legislation surrounding mail-in voting, which varies from state to state.
And if you've already voted but still want to help get out the vote, we'll be providing links for several organizations you can donate to or volunteer for, including the ACLU and the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition.
We can make a difference this election, but only if our voices are heard.
It's like I always say, we're all in this together.
Thanks, guys. Be safe. Vote. And now, on to the show.
Captain Kirk, Spock, Sulu, and the others will reunite one last time when they agree to make Star Trek IX the last payment on Shatner's beach house.
From two corners of the world, it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I'm your co-host, Nick Cooey. Joining me as always is my brother, Alex. I'm stationed out in Beaconsfield, Great Britain. He is just on the outskirts of Minneapolis in the great state of Minnesota. And good afternoon. Well, right. Yeah, good afternoon to your time, Alex. It's evening over here, but just wanted to check in and see.
And good evening to your time. Or I guess since you're in England, I should say, like, good evening.
No, don't do that. There, you'll get a right good thrashing. But how are you doing back in Minnesota, Alex?
Well, you know, it's been a very mixed bag of beans here in the United States. I mean, as I'm recording, of course, it's been 4 days since the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And which has been a shock to the nation, as you probably have read about in the news. And of course, though, that hasn't stopped our Republican politicians from trying to hurry in a new Supreme Court nominee, despite them saying, we don't want to put in a Supreme Court nominee during an election year when it was a Democrat in charge.
Yeah, so aside from institutional hypocrisy that could be upending the court system in America, everything else is pretty okay then, huh?
Yes. Small detail.
Yeah, right.
But other than that, it's going well. Actually, the weather's been quite lovely today. I was just out and about, actually, today with our mother, and we were admiring some of the leaves' colors. They're changing colors already, and some of them are just gorgeous.
Well, I mean, you've kind of echoed what I was just saying, or what I'm really how things are going over here, which is that we're seeing quite a huge spike in cases right now, and there's a threat of lockdown again, which is sending, I think, half of the people in a state of panic and the other half in a state of frustration. There's not really a cohesive message right now in terms of other than just don't congregate in groups of six unless you are mandated to do so in the context of a school, which is, you know, us. But I'm not going to pick apart the logic of that. Otherwise, I mean, we could be here all day. All that is to say is that I'm doing just fine. I got done with my first major draft of my dissertation, so I'm able to actually not look at my computer several hours out of the day, reading academia and trying to think within an academia-specific mindset. I mean, not that I don't like reading academia, but, you know, when you kind of commit to it for a week on end with no rest, I mean, you're kind of looking to alternate with something a little simple, you know, watch like a, I don't know, like some sort of a, not a Michael Bay movie, but some sort of a popcorn film. And, you know, in a weird way, Alex, what we're going to be talking about today is could be construed as something of a popcorn film, though it's earned the moniker of an art house foreign film over the last 20 years or so, or at least that's sort of been its reputation within particular circles. And the film, the latest...
Well, it's both an art house film, but it's also, I think, considered a major blockbuster, and a highly influential one at that, too.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, when... I was thinking to begin this episode, I know that it feels like 10 years ago, or a lifetime ago, but one of the few good things that happened, one of the few qualitatively decent things that happened in 2020 was that the first foreign language film won the Best Picture Oscar with Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. But this film that we're going to talk about today in our latest episode of our 2000 retrospective, I would argue came as close as any other foreign film has ever come to winning the Best Picture Oscar. And that film is Ong Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And it's a film that, you know, I don't know, Alex, I would assume a lot of people have seen it, but maybe I'm wrong in that assumption, because the film was, for a brief moment, really, as you said, a global phenomenon and a huge box office hit. And I'm not sure how much of that has resonated with the, I don't want to say the millennials these days, but with young people born within the last 10 years. If they come to a movie like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I think that, you know, we'll get into the topic of its qualities as a film later on, but just to say, I don't know if a younger generation coming into Crouching Tiger today would quite understand how big this film really was. Because, I mean, you and I, when we first saw this, we were kids, on home video even. That's how you know that we're starting to get to be a little bit little creaky in the bones there, is that we watched this.
Back in my day, there used to be a thing called a VHS, video home system.
Yeah, I think it's all going to be in our memoirs about video stores and the mythical allure of
them. I've got the chapter titles down in my mind already.
Fantastic. I'm done writing chapters after my dissertation melee, but for the time being, I would say that, yeah, do you think, Alex, just looking back on the film now, like, do you remember what your first impressions of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon even were?
You know, I kind of do remember, and it's remarkable to think about. When I think of that movie, I do think of a time period in my life, yeah, when I was like 9 years old when the movie came out, because, yeah, it came around the Christmas holiday season and then expanded in early 2001, and I believe the first visual of the film that really stuck out to me was, I remember it was in our elementary school, we had this music choir class, and I remember on the top shelf, our music teacher had a copy of the film soundtrack. So I just remember seeing that, and that sticking out to me. So I was aware of that title and of it getting some praise and playing in theaters and getting awards recognition. But I remember eventually when we got to see it on home video, I do remember being pretty much blown away by what I was watching. I mean, granted, since I was a 9-year-old Westerner, but it was kind of unlike anything I had ever seen before, from the fighting choreography to the visual aesthetic of the film to even the music by Tan Dun, who is actually more notable for being a contemporary classical composer.
Right, And I was just going to say that, you know, we were not really a what you might call a martial arts or kung fu household. So we didn't really grow up on a lot of wuxia films. We had never heard of anybody like King Hu, let alone Bruce Lee was kind of, even then, I would say, something of a glimmer in our eye at that point. But Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon definitely, I mean, by virtue of it being in a lot of ways the first major martial arts movie that we had seen, it was a really striking thing to watch at such a young age. And I think it actually really works as a film when you come into it at 9 years old, because watching it again the other day, it just struck me how really simple the whole story actually is.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there are lots of components and details and subtext that you can dissect and analyze, but when you just look at the story itself, and if you were to summarize it to somebody, you could be pretty succinct about it.
Right. I mean, it's a fable. I mean, it is based on one part of a 5-part series that was written around the Second World War by Wang Dulu. And yeah, essentially the story, it's as simple as they can get, I think, within this sort of epic scope, which is just that a swordsman over in the Qing Dynasty, so approximately around maybe the 18th century, though the film never explicitly specifies what year it's set in, a famed swordsman named Li Mu Bai visits a peer and frankly intimate colleague named Yu Shu Lian, and he is giving up his sword, which is the Green Destiny Sword. He wants to give it to a nobleman named Sir Ti over in Beijing, and he asks Yu Shu Lian to deliver it, and she does, but no sooner has she delivered the sword than it is stolen. And thankfully, the film makes pretty clear who stole it, and thankfully, the characters catch on very quickly as well. And that's the one thing that I do appreciate about this film, is that even though it's a very simple story, it doesn't treat the audience in a patronizing manner in that way. And the thief, the culprit, really, is this young girl who in English is, her name is subtitled as Jen, but I think it's actually more important to, for the purposes of linking it to the title of the film, to say her name, what her name is originally, which is Zhao Long. And the reason I'm specifying that is because the title of the film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it translates, the word for, this is something I hadn't known until I did a little research, but apparently the word for dragon in Mandarin is Long. So already you have the word Long contained within her name. And then the word for tiger is Hu. And that's important because the other character who has that is a young puckish rogue named Zhao Hu, a.k.a. Dark Cloud. And he's this brigand who Zhao Long met in the desert in a flashback that we see. And he stole a comb of hers and she pursues him. And of course, they fall in love. And so already you have these threads of romance, of intrigue, of redemption of honor. And of course, we haven't even mentioned that there's a revenge subplot involving a wicked criminal named Jade Fox, who has murdered, or who did murder, the master of Li Mu Bai. And of course, Li Mu Bai wants to avenge his master's death. So it has all of these ingredients that are in place for what I would consider a fairly enjoyable adventure yarn. But I think we have to specify specifically what it is about the film that made it so unique in the time that it came out. Because, again, like I said, like I've been saying with the story, like it's when you break it down, it's working in very basic archetypal structures. But where the film really shines is in the action sequences. And again, right around like the 15-minute mark, we have our first major fight set piece. And if I'm not mistaken, Alex, this film premiered out of competition at Cannes. And at the first scene where you see a character literally flying through the air, the audience got up and cheered, didn't they?
Yeah, that's what I heard. Like, the audience just went nuts when that happened in Cannes.
It's one of those things that it's kind of entered the anecdotal annals of legend in Cannes premiere history. Like this, like the whole mystique now surrounding when Force Majeure first screened, and people felt like watching that avalanche sequence, it felt like the avalanche was coming right at them, and it was like a simulation of that Lumiere Brothers film, The Train Arriving at the Station. But to get back to Crouching Tiger, these fight sequences, there's something about the way that, watching it again, the film's dynamic between the tactile and the tangible, in the sense that it really doesn't use a lot of computer-generated effects. There's maybe only a few instances where you can kind of notice that, okay, they had to use computer effects for this shot or that shot. But for the most part, a lot of it is...
And of course, to digitally remove the wires when they fly.
Well, of course. Unfortunately, people can't actually fly while they're performing feats of derring do and impressive martial arts. But there's something great, too, about the way that the film makes use of the tactile. Even when these characters are performing these unreal feats of physical strength. Like, for example, in the first fight sequence, it's a chase sequence, essentially, where this thief has stolen the sword, the Green Destiny sword, and then Xu Lian is giving chase. And, of course, there are these gorgeous shots of them floating and bouncing gracefully off of the rooftops. And then there are even moments where when she's trying to get the thief down, she makes use of a couple of real props, like a sack of flour or hay bale, or even some stones that she tries to throw. She tries to drag the thief down at one point off the wall. Like, it's this unreal zero gravity simulation, and yet you do, the first time you watch it, you can only just look slack-jawed and wonder, how the hell did they do that?
I know. I mean, it's still, watching it again, I think the fight sequences hold up 100%. Completely. Actually, 120%, I should say.
That's mathematically incorrect, but I completely agree with you, nevertheless.
Well, it defies mathematics. It defies the laws of gravity. And maybe, I think, I mean, we can't give enough credit to the choreographer, Yuen Woping, who I think a lot of Western audiences had also become familiar with his work just recently at that time for the fight sequences of The Matrix, which also were eye-popping and, jaw-dropping for audiences as well.
But he had also been around for a while. Like, I know, of course, he was the choreographer as well for Drunken Master, the Jackie Chan film. And so he had some experience with sort of kung fu and fight films within that East Asian market for quite a number of years. But yeah, The Matrix and Crouching Tiger, those just back-to-back really helped catapult him within an international recognition, particularly within the mainstream.
And I did also, when looking up and studying for this podcast review, I listened to details of, like, how they were able to pull off the effects, so, like, with the wires, and they have, like, for example, five guys working on the wires of one person behind the camera, and how tricky it is. But I just watched the film, and I still can't believe how, you know, because I imagine it must have been a nightmare just to do it, just one of the many difficulties they had to endure throughout the production. But when you watch the final film, it just looks so graceful and effortless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's this there's a little line where there's a line when a character, I believe it's Xu Lian, refers to the Green Destiny sword as the lightest of weapons, and yet it ends up being heavy for Zhao Long. And I think there's actually something where that's a very subtle commentary on the film itself. That sort of dynamic of, you feel the sense of, again, the physical sensation of the actors in a real space, but they're defying all sense of physics. And again, there are some justly praised sequences of real beauty. I mean, particularly a fight scene on top of these bamboo trees that, when you watch it again, I mean, it really is just incredible.
I mean, especially when you think that, when we watch a lot of action movies nowadays, you just have people, like, in front of a green screen, and it's like, oh, wow, look, I guess they're really on top of these bamboo trees. But no, they actually shot at a bamboo forest, and they're really there, 70 feet up high on the top of these trees. And so it's the fine balance between realism and fantasy that I think that's what pulled me in the first time I saw it. And I think I could, because it felt like I had, watching that film for the first time, it felt like I had been transported between the fight sequences and the look of the world with the city, and also in the Gobi Desert. I felt like I had been transported to a different world. You know, forget like about a different time or a different nation, but it feels like a different world.
Well, and I think that remark in itself, I think, is very revealing, because I think that taps into a lot of what made the film such a huge draw for audiences in America specifically. There is that sense of exoticization in the film, which I think could be construed as something problematic. But at the same time, it's unsurprising, considering that this film was an international co-production between the United States, Taiwan, and China.
And there's also funding from, like, France and Scandinavia as well.
Well, there you go. I mean, so clearly there's this desire to ensure that the film conforms to something which engages an international audience. And really, that's another thing that makes Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon such a unique film, in that it is one of the first major transnational blockbusters. I mean, if you really think about it, Alex, I have a hard time coming up with other films from outside of Hollywood that have penetrated the mainstream so deeply, simply because they are actively looking to strike this balance between a multicultural or multinational amalgamation of story tropes. Because this film definitely, it has, I was kind of referencing earlier in terms of Wuxia films, it's absolutely in the vein of King Hu's work, like Touch of Zen or Dragon Inn. And in fact, the whole bamboo sequence in Crouching Tiger, it's almost like the opposite of this more earthbound but no less glorious bamboo fight sequence in A Touch of Zen. But that being said, the film also conforms to what I think you could consider a pretty traditional screenplay structure. Again, there's the whole trope of at the 20-minute mark, the first major event will happen, and right on the dot at the 20-minute mark, the sword is stolen, and thus the plot gets kicked into gear. And there are these elements even of the Western, and you were telling me that apparently Sergio Leone was an influence on Ang Lee for this film as well?
In ways, like actually, and this is kind of an interesting piece to point out, because it shows the kind of that mixture of Eastern and Western influences and how they dictate this movie. But the character of Jade Fox is played by Cheng Peipei, who a lot of Eastern audiences, she actually got her start to working with the through Shaw Brothers Studio Pictures. Actually, she was in a King Hu film, Come Drink With Me.
Mm.
So, and even when I was listening to the audio commentary by Ang Lee and by executive producer and co-screenwriter James Seamus, they essentially compared her casting, because she had been known for playing like protagonists in these wuxia films, typically. And so her playing this kind of antagonist, they compared that to the casting of Henry Fonda in Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West.
Mm. Though, I mean, if I have to be honest, I feel like her character is actually more sympathetic. I mean, not to say that she isn't villainous or treacherous or, you know, even cowardly in the fact that she eschews the honor and integrity of the Wudang philosophy. I mean, because her motive's fighting is primarily utilizing poison, and of course it's a very cowardly way of smiting your enemies. But at the same time, the film is sympathetic to her and also the other two women characters of Shulian and Zhaolong. And also, I think it's just important to, you were talking a little bit about the casting, I just wanted to mention really briefly that the rest of the cast of the main actors in this film, I mean, they were all to varying degrees well known in the West. Well, some of them were, like Chow Yun-fat, of course, he was very well known for the Hong Kong work that he was doing with John Woo. Michelle Yeoh had just before this been in the James Bond film, I want to say Tomorrow Never Dies.
Tomorrow Never Dies. I mean, Michelle Yeoh also had been well established as like an action star in Hong Kong for many years before doing this film.
Oh yeah, she was in Police Story 3, Super Cop.
Yeah, with Jackie Chan. That's right. So it was kind of interesting because this movie, even though it has her in an action role, but it also kind of showcased her more dramatic sensibilities, which maybe people took for granted or didn't notice. And actually, she even received a BAFTA nomination for her performance in this movie. And so afterwards, it's interesting to think how afterwards she had also been cast in maybe roles that didn't showcase so much the action qualities, but maybe more her acting chops.
Well, because Michelle Yeoh has this real sense of command and authority and wisdom in playing a character like Julien. And I think that that sort of maturity or that sense of groundedness, that perspicacity, does lend itself well to these other roles that she's played where she's had to be kind of a figure of authority or of wisdom. Like, I mean, and this is a pretty eclectic comparison, but, you know, thinking of like Kung Fu Panda 2 or even Crazy Rich Asians, you know, she is playing these characters who there's always that sense of gravitas that's associated with them, you know, and she is the kind of actress that can really pull that off. And she pulls it off really well here, too.
And I think Chow Yun-Fat pulls that off quite well, too.
Oh, you know, yeah.
I think having that experience, and it's interesting how he had just he was starting to just really get attention in the West. Like, he had just been in his first Western film, like, a couple of years prior to this, The Replacement Killers. And then he was just in, like, you know, Anna and the King with Jodie Foster. So he also was just starting to become known in the West. And then Zhang Ziyi, this is the film that kind of really essentially made her a star.
Well, exactly. I mean, this really catapulted her to stardom. She had been in a couple of other projects, but yeah, this was really the thing that launched her it really put her on the map. And then Cheng Chen, who plays Zhou Hu, he was in a few films beforehand, and he had been working with, I mean, the thing is, like, he cut his teeth working with some pretty great directors like Edward Yang and Wong Kar-wai, but this was also a big breakthrough for him too. So it's, and I think that all of the cast, like, the main cast does a really splendid job here in terms of like you said, they all meet the material with a sense of solemnity and gravitas, but not in a monotonous or I would say even two-dimensional manner. I think that there's, for example, okay, like the character that Cheng Chen plays, you know, I mean, he is, if you really break it down, he is the roguish scoundrel with a heart of gold. You know, he's just a couple of degrees to the left of Han Solo, if you think about it. But at the same time, like, I mean, that's a little reductive, but I think, like, that sort of acting and performance from him, it helps us buy into that character. And then that helps us buy into, ultimately, some of the moments where he establishes some key elements which will play a role in the final scene of the film, particularly the legend surrounding the mist in the mountains. I mean, for everybody who's seen the film, I don't think we're going to spoil this film too much, just if you've never seen it, but I think people who've seen the film will know what we're talking about.
Yeah, but, you know, I also wanted to talk about, because this was a point of controversy, too, when the movie came out about the casting, but because in the movie, the characters speak Mandarin Chinese, but not all of the actors we listed are of Chinese descendants. In fact, the only person who was really, who was a native Mandarin speaker was Zhang Ziyi. Chow Yun-Fat was from Hong Kong. Michelle Yeoh was born in Malaysia and eventually grew up in Hong Kong. And she didn't really read Chinese much before doing this film. And of course, Cheng Chen was from Taiwan. But what do you make of that? Like, do you think that works for or against it, or do you think it also serves as a reflection of the transnational production that it was?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good question. I think it's a fair question. If I have to be brutally honest, I do not know Mandarin well enough to be able to spot somebody's accent being somewhat faulty. I think it's, I mean, I couldn't be able to tell you I could get a vague sense of if I were listening to Mandarin versus Cantonese, but I mean, I really am not a linguistic expert in that field. But I do think it is an interesting point to make in that the film foregoes a little bit of that verisimilitude for the sense of more that they're casting these big names or a promising newcomer who I think they rightly felt could fit the role of Zhao Long. And I think Zhang Ziyi actually walks away with the film. I think she's, in a lot of respects, the real protagonist of the film.
You know, that's what Lee said, too, in the commentary for the film.
Well, I mean, it makes sense, because she's the one who has the full character arc, really, in the film. And she has... And she actually is the centerpiece of, for my money, the best scene in the film, which is this fight sequence in a tavern or an inn. And I mean, we could talk about that sequence quite a bit. I mean, I only just wanted to say, like, watching that sequence again, I was just really struck by, not just in terms of the fight choreography, but the way that Lee utilizes camera angles and camera movement to really emphasize this... these lines and diagonals that bisect and intrude upon the frame to really emphasize a lot of the geometric patterns within his setting. And by doing so, he really keeps constantly producing these visually dynamic images. It's not just simply cutting rapidly for the sense of for the hope that you're going to be stimulating some sort of excitement. It's very carefully thought out and very carefully considered, and all culminates in this glorious wide shot punchline. And another great thing about the film is its widescreen photography. The film makes extremely great use of some gorgeous exterior shots, as well as some widescreen compositions in terms of placement of actors within the mise-en-scene, of giving a sense of even if there's a sense of clutter, but it's organized in that you don't feel like it's messy.
Yeah,
but
actually,
but to get back to your what were you going to say, Alex?
I was just going to say about Peter Paul's cinematography. I agree with you 100%, and I feel that he earned a well-deserved Oscar for his contributions to the movie. And I think there are shots in that movie would just stick with me. Like, my favorite shot in the film is actually, and it sums up my feelings too about the film, is there's a shot where Zhi and Chen are like, they're out of the desert, and they're in this sort of like grassy meadowland with mountains surrounding them. And there's a shot where they come, where Chen comes out of the tent to meet with some people. And you can see like this red either sunrise or sunset. And whenever I see that shot, it always takes my breath away. I'm always left in awe of it. It always feels like I'm watching something magical.
Well, I'll tell you what, it definitely, the desert sequences... Maybe it's because this is just from my perspective, but it definitely has elements of David Lean to them, with just a touch of Lawrence of Arabia. Maybe that's just me, though. I don't know. Did you get that watching the film now?
I could see what you mean. It probably was as difficult for them to shoot in the Gobi Desert as it was for Lean to shoot his desert scenes for Lawrence. I mean, I heard it was a real nightmare. But yeah... Yeah, there is that kind of scope, but there's also...
It's the three things. Three things. Never shoot in the desert, never shoot in a boat, and never shoot in the jungle.
But what about bamboo forest?
That's a distant fourth.
But yeah, like... also, there's a great shot. I love that shot, too. Like, when we... At the start of the desert flashback sequences, you get this wide scope landscape shot of the desert. It kind of looks like a shot from, actually, the beginning of Dr. Zhivago. Mm. And at first you see the desert, and then all of a sudden you start to make out these silhouettes and figures, and you see there's like a whole caravan that, you know, that then emerges.
Well, yeah, it's like they fade in. This caravan of camels just fades into the frame. It's almost as if they are apparitions from a mirage that have materialized. And again, that does feed into the mythical component of the film, because the film is... as we've been talking about, playing with this interesting dynamic between myths and legends and folklore and the tactile, the sense of groundedness of, if we were actually watching one of those legends, what would it look like, so to speak, in real life? And it, again, I think that fundamental question, I'd like to tie that back to what you were talking about earlier in terms of the casting, because I think that is problematic in the sense that of trying to take too much stock in the sense that what we're watching is a faithful reproduction of a particular component of Chinese history. I mean, that isn't to say anybody's going to watch this movie and think to themselves, oh my God, I didn't know human beings could actually fly through the air and fight on bamboo stalks. But I think that there is a tricky, it's a very, very fine line, isn't it, between making something exotic, but then at the same time making it accessible. And I don't know about whether the casting how that ultimately, I mean, for me, it's not a huge problem, but of course I can understand how that could irk some viewers. And I think, more than anything, it's just a reflection of a particular model or approach towards casting in a film that we've only seen has actually become more and more prominent since Crouching Tiger was released. I mean, not even a year, or really a year, after Crouching Tiger came out, there were already films that were operating in the similar vein of the Wuxia subgenre, like Hero or House of Flying Daggers. And so clearly this is it established a formula in terms of these Wuxia exports that could make some money in the United States. Crouching Tiger showed that they could, because it was, and I think it still is, the highest grossing foreign film in United States history.
Yeah, it like grossed over $130 million on a $17 million budget.
I mean, yeah, that's not too shabby. But I do think that thinking about just in terms of the way that other Wuxia films that came after Crouching Tiger applied some of its approaches towards, in terms of its dramatic strains or dramatic rhythms and beats concerning romance and tragedy. I'm thinking specifically of Hero, because Hero is, I think, it's an interesting film to compare to Crouching Tiger in the fact that it implements doomed romance. In fact, interestingly enough, it casts two of the martial arts masters in the film are the two stars that we were talking about just last week, Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung. So clearly there was as much of an influence from In the Mood for Love as there was for Crouching Tiger. But it makes sense, because both of those movies, of course, In the Mood for Love wasn't a phenomenon like Crouching Tiger was, but it was a hit. And it did cause a stir in certain cinephile circles that Crouching Tiger, I don't think, quite did. I mean, of course, you know, you couldn't go anywhere without talking about Crouching Tiger. But that's all to say that just thinking about comparing a movie like Hero and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, in terms of the way that they implement these sorts of transnational components of casting, of storytelling, of hitting these broad strokes, I think what's interesting to compare Crouching Tiger to Hero is that Crouching Tiger is, by and large, even though it is critical of a social structure which condemns women to these stringent social roles, in either with Michelle Yeoh's character, who is consigned to the role of an itinerant, lonely swordsman who cannot express her true feelings for the man she loves, Li Mu Bai. You have her on one end. On the other hand, you have Zhang Ji's character, Zhao Long, who is engaged to marry a man who I don't think we actually ever see in this film.
I think maybe just briefly in a wedding procession parade, but he doesn't get any lines. And so we never see them together.
No, he's completely incidental. he is the living embodiment of a plot device.
He's like Prince Valium from Spaceballs.
Yeah. But what I was just going to say was that what Crouching Tiger is doing is that it is offering sort of this broader critique of any social structure that's condemning women to be in these constrictive roles and trying to present this almost fantasy. I mean, I don't want to say fantasy in the sense of sounding condescending, but it is like this wish fulfillment of these women being able to transcend these roles. And I mean, and the same thing with Jade Fox as a character, as an antagonist. I was saying that I found her more sympathetic than Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West. I mean, only because Henry Fonda in that movie is just a stone cold bastard. But in this movie, Jade Fox she's illiterate. She realizes that her disciple, Zhao Long, is surpassing her in terms of technique and skill only because she's able to read. And she's not telling Jade Fox because she doesn't want to make her feel embarrassed. And that wounds her. And the thing is, I think what's great about the film is that it actually does convey that sense of empathy for an antagonist like Jade Fox. That you don't see her as something to demonize.
And she even wanted to learn the Wudang manual. And actually, she says at one point early on that she consulted Li Mu Bai's master and even slept with them, see if he would teach her, but he still refused to. So still, that there is that exploitation. With that comes that wounded anger.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But again, like, that's something that, I mean, that's a topic which I think has universal resonance. Whenever there's any patriarchal society that is condemning women to these very strict social roles, I think that component is not simply present in China or in the United States. Whereas a film like Hero, I'm going to go and just spoil a little bit of Hero here, but in the sense that by the end of Hero, the message that it gives is one of national unity, of a China that is united. And that's speaking to a very particular political strain that's, I think, it makes sense in the context of post-reunification with Hong Kong. And I think watching Hero, I mean, I watched it for the first time earlier this year, and I have to admit that once that I realized that was sort of the moral of the film, I have to confess that it felt a little problematic in light of how the last 20 years have gone down.
I mean, it is. I've seen Hero 2, and yeah, that little tail end is a tad problematic. But, you know, I wanted to, you know, to tap into some of the themes which you have been discussing about, like, also confronting these patriarchal norms and rules that people have to follow or adhere to. And, you know, and I think when you have these characters who struggle to do that, especially, it's like the struggle of balance between, like, you know, as cliche as it sounds, but between following your heart and following what society dictates.
Or what duty compels you to do.
And I think those are themes which are very prevalent in the works of Ang Lee, actually. I think many of his movies, they are about characters who are going through that struggle. And I think what makes him such an appealing director, and I think why he's able to make his transition to the West so effortlessly, was because he found stories where he could also be able to approach or address that, whether it's like in when he made his Western debut with Jane Austen, of all things, with Sense and Sensibility. Or if you look at, of course, just 5 years later with another one of his bigger films, Brokeback Mountain, between these two cowboys who realize they're gay and they fall in love with each other, but they also have to uphold that conservative heterosexual machismo masculinity. And
well, right, or like even thinking about some of his less known titles, I mean, the film that he made right before Crouching Tiger is a little known American film, Ride with the Devil, and it got the director's cut got released by Criterion about a decade ago. And frankly, I mean, it was one of those movies I'd never heard of when it first came out. I just saw the DVD cover, and the DVD cover is this gorgeous still of this horse running past a flaming house. And I remember seeing that, and I was like, Ang Lee made this movie? I've never heard of it. How have I've got to see this movie. And I will say, like, the film does conform to some of those themes that you're talking about in terms of this. That film is about Tobey Maguire in the Civil War, who's falling in love with the woman who his brother loves, but also there's this parallel sense of attachment to the lost cause of the Confederacy. And it is interesting that Ang Lee has adopted he's adopted that fundamental approach, but to different historical and cultural milieu, as we've been talking about.
And even in some of his lesser films, like, I think that's apparent, prevalent in lots of his films, even in something like The Hulk. I think that you can also do a reading of that in that film.
Well, that movie's all about suppressed emotion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because if you let it out, you turn into a giant, muscular, green monster. But
you turn into Shrek's Botox-laden cousin.
I think he's interested in his films focusing on, like, outsiders or people who don't quite fit the mold of what's considered acceptable by societal terms or standards, because he himself was kind of an outsider. I mean, when he was born in Taiwan, but his parents were actually refugees. They had fled to the mainland of China following the end of the communist victory of the Civil War.
Okay, so he was actually a lot like Edward Yang then, in that sense, because he also fled to, his family fled to Taiwan, And yeah. And it's actually, sorry to interrupt you, but Alex, but I mean, one thing that did occur to me is that I think Ang Lee's placement within film history, as well as that I think is important to note, is that he was part of the second wave of the New Taiwan cinema, because he was coming around in the early 90s along with Tsai Ming-liang, who I think it's interesting to note, Tsai Ming-liang made this movie called Goodbye Dragon Inn, which is about... It's just sort of a slow cinema meditation set within a movie theater who's screening its last movie. And it's the last movie it's screening is King Hu's Dragon Inn. So there is this sense of nostalgia that's permeating through that film for this bygone edifice. And of course, channeled through that is the film itself, which is a core part of this nostalgic reverie. And yeah, I mean, I can't help but wonder if Crouching Tiger is also a little nostalgic for Ang Lee as well, at least, or that it's tapping into that nostalgia.
Yeah, like I said, I even saw this video on YouTube where it was at the Walker Art Center many years ago with James Seamus. They were talking about many things, like their collaborative history together, because Seamus, who a lot of you may know now as the CEO of Focus Features, he had collaborated with Lee on basically all his movies. Good Machine, which was the name of the production company which Seamus ran with Ted Hope, kind of helped to raise funds for his first film, Pushing Hands. And then they collaborated all the way up to Taking Woodstock. But he talked about at one point how, as he was growing up, how he always felt kind of like an outsider from like the fact of being the son of these Chinese refugees to... Then when he was growing up, and then when he went to America to like study and then also try to get some work in the film industry. And here he was like as a Taiwanese immigrant in America. And then eventually when he goes to visit China, he didn't feel like he was a Chinese person, but he was like a Taiwanese American. So always he felt kind of that outsider status. And I think that's an intriguing and a very personal angle that he lends to a lot of his movies. There was a quote that I found actually in an essay article when I was reading to prep for this. This was quoted by Kenneth Chan, which I think also sums up his views, and I think about how he wanted to make this film. This is the quote. He said, "The film is a kind of dream of China, a China that probably never existed except in my boyhood fantasies in Taiwan. Of course, my childhood imagination was fired by the martial arts movies I grew up with and by the novels of romance and derring do I read instead of doing my homework. That these two kinds of dreaming should come together now in a film I was able to make in China is a happy irony for me." So I think the fact that here it was this young boy growing up in Taiwan and with these impressionistic views of what China must have been like, and then in weaving this kind of world in his imagination, because that was a passion of his. He always wanted to make a martial art, a wuzhou film for many years. And that wasn't until he read the book of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon in 1994, he knew that was the one he wanted to make into a movie. And so I think, so that kind of impressionistic and in seeing how he's an outsider himself, I think that really informs a lot of the look of the film, and also into the casting itself, because even though he has actors who aren't from China, but he still has them speaking Mandarin Chinese, because I think it's a way to inform people like, yes, this story is set in China, so we're telling a Chinese story, but it's still a story that could be appealing to both Eastern and Western audiences. I mean, even Seamus described it as saying making an Eastern film for Western audiences, or making a more Western kind of film for Eastern audiences too. And, you know, I feel like that really sums up the entirety. That really sums up Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the film in a nutshell.
Oh, you know, one thing, I know I just brought him up a couple of minutes ago, but I mean, just the way that you're describing Ang Lee's self-identification as an outsider through him growing up in Taiwan, and then, of course, occupying this in-between space between Taiwan and America, I really can't help but think again of someone like Edward Yang, who I think was also very similar in that sense, that his family's fled from Shanghai. He did study in America, and he was sort of bouncing in between those two spaces. And, of course, there's that element, too, of tragedy in both of their movies. I mean, Yi, which we just talked about a couple of weeks ago, certainly has some tragic elements. Brighter Summer Day definitely has a lot of tragedy in it. But
lots of Ang Lee films have tragedy in them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ang Lee. Oh, yeah. You brought up Brokeback Mountain earlier. And, you know, regardless of whether you love that movie or don't love it, it definitely has one of the most devastating last 10 minutes of any movie I've ever seen. And
I saw it again last year, actually, and I saw it with a family member of ours, and I will confess, like, when after the film ended, I think there were tears in my eyes, and I was choked up.
I mean, you know, it's a grade A weepy, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I still think his darkest and bleakest film is The Ice Storm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we hadn't... Yeah, because that's the one that we had forgotten to mention, but that one was... That one's a really excellent film, too. And that one also is very... it's utilizing a very particular era in American history of this time of the 1970s, but to offer a pretty blistering critique of this petite bourgeois middle class that's confining itself to this deadening sense of significance or self-importance that really has no base value in anything. I mean, and it's pretty unsparing, I would say. But just to get back to this dynamic between Yang and Lee, I wanted to ask you, what do you think is it about Ang Lee that made him so almost right off the bat this more, I would say, maybe accessible, but certainly much more successful international figure than someone like Edward Yang, who it's only just taken years now after his passing for him to really find an audience, and maybe not a mainstream audience, but an audience nevertheless?
That's a good question. I think it's a combination of the fact that, again, because he was able to make accessible films to Western audiences, and I think with that outsider mindset that I think that he seemed to have felt his entire life, I think, and how he inserted and injected that into his work, I think Western audiences just really responded to that strongly. And I think because of the empathy, because even though, yeah, like, except for maybe The Ice Storm, which is a very blistering and damning film, but I think for more often than not, he's actually quite empathetic to his characters in a lot of his movies. And I think that empathy really moves audiences, and that's why they go to see his films, whether it's, again, it's Sense and Sensibility, or whether it's a Chinese Wuzhou film, or if it's a film about gay cowboys.
Or I was just going to say that in Ride with the Devil, even though it's a film that I don't love, but it does have one of the more interesting characters I've seen in a Civil War set film, which is a former slave played by Jeffrey Wright, who is still living with his old master. And of course, that character could have just been a complete catastrophe, but in Wright's hands, and with the script that Seamus helped co-write, it ends up being a really complex and rich character. And of course, I mean, Wright's a tremendous actor, so he completely makes this character feel like a fully realized person.
God love him. Well, and I also think about a film like, even something like Life of Pi is a film too that, which is interesting because you have a story where the main character's outside of all, you know, we see what his life is like and all his upbringing and the things he's learned. And now he's thrust into a situation where they're almost, all these customs or so are completely insignificant. He's got to go down to the bare essence of the essentials of survival, you know, between him and this tiger on this boat. But it still ties into some of the themes of, like, grief and loss and how, you know, you process it and, you know, finding the will to live, especially through the power of faith. And it could be very fantastical because the way, with all the CGI, he shoots like a Paul Pressburger film.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to be entirely honest, Alex, from my perspective, I'm I get where you're coming from, and I do think that Life of Pi is an interesting story in the way that it teases out several ambiguities, but I do think it does mark the beginning of a moment in Lee's career where he begins to, I think, stray away from the tactile in favor of the fantastical. I mean, whereas Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I think, strikes a really nice balance between those two elements, I think, you know, you start to see more of him, of Lee trying to kind of do things that are formally and aesthetically maybe more adventurous, but they might not, they might kind of drown out sort of the sense of human connection, or at least like a sense of that, of recognition. Because, I mean, even with something like when you were talking about Powell and Pressburger, I mean, even though they had a lot of fantastical elements, but those fantastical elements, and maybe it's because they didn't have CGI, who knows, they could have really used CGI quite a bit had it existed back in the 40s and 50s. But I do think that there is this also, the way that they play with perspective and the practical, the use of practical effects, that makes their work kind of quite beguiling and charming. Whereas I think Life of Pi is a really technically proficient work, but I think it does come to the point where it does turn the whole story into a spectacle more than it is a just an intimate story. But I mean, that's just my perspective. But I do think that you do raise some interesting points about how it fits within Lee's filmography. And honestly, looking back at Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I do think that it does signify some elements in his work that he would begin to really lean into later on, and for better and for worse. But for me, I think that there's this... I think the film works. And I think it just works primarily because it's attempting to frame this question of what constitutes a notion of the transcendent. You were talking about faith earlier, and in a way, like, if Life of Pi is a Christian fable, then Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is a Buddhist fable, of course. Now, I think it's Buddhist in the sense that the question to this, the answer to this question that it poses about what constitutes the transcendent is love. And that might seem like something of a cop-out in terms of it just being an easy cookie-cutter or popcorn-fare solution. But I think even though it might not match something like the spiritual resonance or complexity of A Touch of Zen, I think nevertheless, Crouching Tiger does prove to be a popcorn-fare that is of the highest caliber. And I think ultimately, while it's methods of mixing East and Western tropes might occupy sort of an uneasy balance, it nevertheless does signify its, or I think it all just serves to cement the film's place within film history as what is really a landmark in terms of transnational filmic entertainment. And I do think, like we've been talking about, looking at it 20 years later, it has its fair share of filmmaking, which still stands up. So I think that's kind of, you know, they might be giving the game away, but I would say, especially if you've never seen it, if you're somebody who was born after the sensation and the fad of this movie really reached its zenith within the cultural zeitgeist, definitely check out Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I think you'll be really pleasantly surprised by how well it holds up. I certainly was.
Yeah, I'm glad it held up so well for you. And I was going to say, like, in terms of Lee's more recent work, I have been curious in how he's experimented with, like, say, for example, shooting at 4K, 120 frames per second. Because, you know, I know this is where we kind of differ, but because I think you're more of an old-fashioned kind of 24 frames per second
celluloid guy. I'm more aesthetically conservative than you are, I would say.
I mean, for me, I'm curious always in, like, finding different, especially with the way technology keeps moving forward, I'm always curious in seeing how people can use it to advance or change the form. But with that said, I do agree with you, like, I don't think I would revisit films like Life of Pi as much as Crouching Tiger. And I think you hit right on the nail with everything you said of why it holds up. I think because it is very lyrical. It's transcendental. It is transporting, but it's not a case of style over substance. I don't think. I think it has a lot of it has intriguing characters that are complex, and there's a lot of it's got a passionate heart to it that I think would get your audience invested in the story to get them through in between all the action scenes. Because it's one thing if you have like sensational action scenes, but if you don't have good characters, then there's just no point. The people just won't care. They won't sit down to watch it.
Well, but if I think, you have no characters, and if you don't shoot your action scenes in a very deliberate way and in a meaningful way that moves the story forward. And I do think, that Lee's use of the action set pieces is very economical and pretty precise.
But I also mentioned the characters too, because this is going to be another point of controversy for us. And I know we kind of alluded to this before, I feel, but you know, I'll just come out and say this, I've even talked about this with our family before, but honestly, in terms of like an action film that was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars for 2000, I certainly prefer this over The Winner. And I know that the other film, A Sword and Sandals epic, had its sort of influence, like it kind of revived that for a while, but that was even more short-lived than the Wuzhou rejuvenation. But I would still recommend to people to check out Crouching Tiger, because like you said, even if people were born like maybe 10 years after this came out, you can its influence is still prevalent, and not just the films that you mentioned, but I also think in some like more Western produced productions which were kind of inspired by dipping into Eastern cultures. Like I think other works that are indebted to it are like even in animation, like the Kung Fu Panda films, or even Avatar: The Last Airbender. Even though those are more fantastical, but I still think if there was no Crouching Tiger, I don't think we would have gotten those. And so if you're curious, I definitely say check it out. I was looking for, honestly, this was the one I was looking forward to the most of all the movies we're going to be discussing. And I feel it still holds up for me. I still love it. One of the great transportive experiences.
So, yeah, check it out. But I think it's a strong film. And I'm curious to maybe once we get to the end of our miniseries to kind of talk a little more about how you would rank it, you know, both in terms of the Best Picture films and in terms of some of the other East Asian films that we've been talking about in the last couple of weeks. But for now, I think we should go into our weekly section of where we talk about recommendations from the last week of film viewing. So, Alex, what's good out there? What should we be seeing that you've just discovered?
Oh boy. I was looking forward to this because
Uh-oh.
I've actually seen a lot of...
Uh-oh.
I've been seeing a lot of pretty good films, actually, that I was thinking, should I talk about this or that? Like, I was thinking maybe I could tie it into discussing about the adaptation, Frank Borzage's adaptation of Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, starring Gary Cooper. Or maybe I could talk about instead another tragic international feature, Pedro Almodovar's High Heels, which also has a couple major female characters in it. But I decided to do something a little different, something a little mainstream, but something which I didn't really have plans to watch, but our family was watching it the other night, and I decided, sure, I'll give this a go. Why not? I mean, it's also in the Criterion Collection, so it must mean it has some merit. And in this case, it's the 1996 Michael Bay classic, The Rock.
Okay, I'm listening.
That's why when you mentioned Michael Bay at the start, I'm like, very interesting choice of words.
So Well, but you know what? I mean, I can't say that I've seen The Rock, but from what I understand, it's also
I'll tell you what it's about.
I mean, I know kind of go ahead and tell us all. What is, pray tell, Alex, what is The Rock about?
Yeah. And what does this rock pertain to? Well, it is about where Ed Harris plays General Hummel. He is a highly decorated war veteran, but he's very disenchanted with the government due to the covert operations he has done over the years, like in Vietnam and Operation Desert Storm, in which his men had been killed in action, but which the government has refused to acknowledge any of these operations. So in a last sort of desperate attempt to get some recognition and acknowledgement, he assigns a rogue team of Marines, and he leads them, along with his second-in-command, David Morse, to take over the prison island of Alcatraz and hold 81 hostages, while also securing some chemical weapons, and demand that they are paid $100 million, or else they will unleash these chemical weapons by rocket onto San Francisco. And these chemical weapons, they're bad. I mean, just, they're like coming these little green balls. So just one of them breaks.
I mean, they're chemical weapons. Like, of course they're bad.
Yeah. But like these one, like, even they're like, they're so bad, no one knows why in God's name they would make them or something. But, yeah, just one of them breaking could, if you're near it, you're like, you're fucked. Like, the only way you could be able to help, you know, heal yourself from it, the only thing is to inject this antidote through a needle right into your heart.
Of course.
So, it was 2 years after Pulp Fiction, and Tarantino did some uncredited writing, so maybe he inserted that in there. I don't know. But anyways, the government has 24 hours to meet the demands. So, in order to stop them from unleashing these chemical weapons and to rescue the hostages, they recruit an FBI chemist named Stanley Goodspeed, played by the recently Academy Award winner, Nicolas Cage. And so they also assign a prisoner named John Patrick Mason, played by Sean Connery, who apparently was the only person to be able to escape Alcatraz and live to tell the tale. But the question is, will they be able to make it in time? Will they be able to stop Ed Harris from unleashing the weapons? Will Nicolas Cage finally learn how to use a gun and gain his manhood?
Okay, I'm gonna ask what should be a fairly simple question, but it could be a difficult one depending on I think it's whether or not you love or despise Michael Bay cinema. What is it about The Rock that distinguishes itself from Armageddon or, dare I say, the Transformers movies or anything else that he's ever done in his career? What is it about The Rock that makes it? Because from what you've just told us the plot, but you haven't told us if it's any good. I mean, is it good?
No. I mean, like, you know, for me, watching the film, you could ask me all the questions that you probably expect to ask, like if you've seen a Michael Bay film, like, is it full of explosions? Is it dumb? I'm like, oh, absolutely. You have no idea. But in a weird way, and this is going to sound insane, but I kind of liked the movie. I mean, even if I didn't like, I found it fascinating to watch because of how the way that it's made and the way that it's put together. And considering also when it came out in 96, it was during that time period where I think there are action movies that are being made like in this kind of style that I feel like when people were seeing them, they thought were rejuvenating or cool or interesting. I mean, it's kind of like, I think it puts in the same camp as John Woo with the stuff that he was making before he then, and then eventually when he, both in his native land and also when he went to do Face Off in America just a year after The Rock. But I find it fascinating on that score. But also, I think with the action, I think the action's not bad in it. Like, you know, it's got some standard stuff that we've seen before, but the way it's still put together, like, it's not cut as quickly as Armageddon. So you get more of a sense of what's going on. You can maybe appreciate more the way set pieces are put. Like, for example, there's a section involving them trying to outmaneuver some bad guys in these minecarts. And though they don't go as fast as the ones in Temple of Doom. But what also carries the movie, for me anyways, is a couple of major factors. One of them is the three actors, particularly I think Connery and Harris are great in the film. I think Connery is great because he's got that charisma that, you know, you could buy naturally as this sort of character. And Cage, I think, works in... Nicolas Cage works in that way where, he's, of course, supposed to play as a dweeb. And I think with the age gap difference between them, there's that dynamic between him and Connery, which I think is interesting and more believable than if, say, initially they had actually offered the role of Goodspeed to Schwarzenegger. And I don't think that would have worked as well. So Cage also inserts some of his, because he's depicted as kind of like a square, you know, as a gee whiz guy. So, you know, he says things like, for example, one point when they're talking about like how, like this is deep into the film, you fans probably know this scene, but like where they're talking about how Connor is able to break out of prison, he's like,
mine car through the tunnels to the power plant under the steam engine, that was really cool by the way, and into the cistern through the intake pipe, but how, in the name of Zeus's butthole, did you get out of yourself? I only ask because in our current situation, well, it could prove to be useful information. Maybe!
You know, Alex, the more you describe this movie, I don't think it's changing the contention.
I'll get to some of why I liked about it and why I think why I decided to single it out. But I also really liked. I think Harris is great too in it because he also actually he lends a very grounded performance to this character. What could have been very silly. But I think in the movie opens actually with Harris's character, like the opening credits is a montage of seeing him, like, you know, he goes to his wife's grave and says, "How I'm sorry, honey, but this is something I've got to do. You know, I've tried everything." And then when you realize where he's coming from and why he's doing what he's doing, it actually, you kind of, even though you're like, okay, this is wrong what you're doing, but I understand where you're coming from. And I think it ties into some of the themes of, again, that it's that, it's the sense of what it means for, because of how in America we grow up with feeling like the army is like, oh, you gotta not just support the troops, but they're your comrades, your brothers in arms, and you have to support them no matter the cost. But with how our government has, more often than not, kind of tossed them to the wayside. I mean, and it doesn't allude to, like, even a lot of like after they finish their services, but we see how like hard it is for veterans to like get work or get a reasonable living in this nation. And there's also other things too, like about that distrust with government, which I think was prevalent in some work in the 90s, like with Oliver Stone's JFK, and it's there too, where you hear some, you realize some things about, like, it's not just with Harris's distrust with the government. But also you kind of realize how Mason, he was imprisoned because of his past, because he was a British agent, which I know. Sean Connery playing a British agent. Far-fetched, huh? But how he had alleged, how he actually stole some microfilm from J. Edgar Hoover and was trying to smuggle it into Canada. So, and it's supposed to be filled with all these secrets, like apparently, like, who really killed JFK? But I think I think that angle and component was really the reason why I wanted to bring it out, because I think about how, especially, I think we feel that's more prevalent now than even it was in 96, where I think we are, you know, in the United States, and I'm not sure how it is in the UK, but like at least I can say in the United States, there is such a high level of distrust and uncertainty and paranoia and fear, I think, that Americans have over their government, because right now we don't, you know, we have governments that keep saying these bald-faced lies, and we just don't know who to trust anymore. But this isn't anything that's new, and that's kind of what's sad, is that distrust and uncertainty is always there. But you still package it into what essentially is like a film that you can kind of check your brain out of, and you can still have fun with it, you know, and it's not like one of those. Again, because, like you, I'm not a big Michael Bay fan. There are some of his movies I've seen that I've really hated. but this is one which I could at least grasp more of a sense of how it was going down. And I could also, even though, of course, it was ludicrous, but I could sort of get with it and with the suspense of, like, them being able to stop the rockets in time or so, and with the shootouts. And I was having a good time with it. And I think with those angles I talk about, I think that's what makes it, and with the way that it's done, I think that makes it for an interesting piece of that time period of the 90s. And, you know, a critic actually, Tom Ryman from Collider, he actually called The Rock Michael Bay's best film. And honestly, yeah, I can see that of the ones I've seen so far. I would say it's my favorite of his.
Well, maybe one day I will get around to watching it. But I'm glad you liked it. And yeah, it is interesting watching films from the mid-90s that, like that, or Enemy of the State is another one that I'm thinking about that sort of conveys this sense of paranoia and mistrust. But I think that it sort of was hewing a little closer to this end of the millennium angst of a question of uncertainty about where we would go and how we would resolve a lot of the baggage that America has left unresolved over these last, I mean, half a century, really. But yeah, that sounds like a good old romp, and I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, if you want to see something dumb, you know, check it out.
Awesome. Well, you know, I got to be honest. I saw something. Yeah, I mean, I have not been watching a lot, not nearly as much as you have, primarily with dissertation work kind of dominating my nearly every waking moment over the last week and a half or so. But I will say that I did manage to squeeze in a little free time to catch a film that I had not really, I'd only just seen a clip of a few months ago when we were talking about the notion of auteurism in class and thinking about what constitutes an auteur when they're making these sorts of different types of films. How can we give this easily categorifiable label to a film that might seem almost like a working man film or something that could be made by, that could be produced off of an assembly line? And that film is this 1952 Western called Rancho Notorious. I don't know if you've seen this.
Ah, Fritz Lang.
Yeah. It is Fritz Lang movie. Yeah. It was made near in the second half of Fritz Lang's Hollywood career, and it was the last Western that he did. He did several Westerns in his career, and it was the last one he did. And it's a curious film. I mean, just to give you kind of a quick idea of the plot. So the plot of the film, it's about this Wyoming rancher, and his name is Vern Haskell. He's played by Arthur Kennedy, and he swears vengeance on the outlaw who, within the first 5 minutes of the film, robs, sexually assaults, and murders his fiancée, Beth. I mean, it's a pretty brutal way to open the movie, even though, of course, it's not explicit, considering the dictates of the production code. Nevertheless, Vern's pursuit of the killer leads him on this obsessive line of revenge that draws him into this mysterious hideout on the U.S.-Mexican border called Chuckaluck, which is a form of gambling. It's a parlor game for gambling. I didn't know that before I saw this movie, and thankfully the film has a couple of moments where it even asks, what is Chuckaluck, through song via the narrator that constantly sings to us as if the entire film is a ballad being recounted to us. And this ranch, Chuckaluck, is owned and run primarily by this German emigre named Alter Keen, and she's played by none other than, of course, Marlene Dietrich. And before long, Vern instigates this love triangle between himself, Alter, and her partner, both in crime and romantically, Frenchie, who's played by Mel Ferrer. And this is all in serving his quest for revenge. So I mean, just from what I've described it, kind of like The Rock, actually, you'd think just by that basic summary, this is kind of in the realm of absolute cornball, which, again, makes it a rather baffling choice for someone like Fritz Lang, who did M and Metropolis and the Mubuse films, these respectable art house classics from Germany. And what is he doing with this B-movie pulp fare? I mean, you wouldn't be wrong. It's definitely a kitschy movie, and the kitsch is pushed to its limits with this narrator and his warbling basso delivery, as well as the bare-bones budget from RKO that I would say deploys judicious use of what can be seen as blatantly artificial soundstage setups. There's no moment in this movie where you really think to yourself, wow, we're looking at the grand vista of Monument Valley, like in a John Ford Western. It's certainly the stuff of low-grade camp on a superficial level. And it's but not to the camp in the degree that it's not as dreamily feverish as Nicholas Ray's Johnny Guitar.
I'm struggling to see, like, then how, you know, why should I check this out? There are other better long films to see.
Well, I'll tell you why you should check out Rancho Notorious, because underscoring the absurdity of the low budget, of some of the kitschier elements, is this real emotional savagery that is textbook long. And it's a savagery that dispenses of any heroic pretenses. And the film is interesting. You know, I saw earlier this year, too, Bud Bedeker's Ride Lonesome, which is also a film that utilizes the trope of a man revenging his dishonored wife. And while Bedeker was also a low-budget filmmaker, and he utilized a lot of outdoor landscapes to lend his story these poetic, elegiac sparseness to his story, what Long is doing here is he is taking this protagonist played by Kennedy, and who I think just also needs to be noted, played Biff Loman in the original Broadway production of Death of a Salesman. He takes Kennedy, and Kennedy, in his not ugly but not really traditional handsome movie star features, ingests this fury to the degree that it transforms his features into this perpetual grimace, brimming with glowering, ferocious contempt. And so the interplay between artifice and this disarming cruelty is, I think, emblematized in this really great scene. And it's a musical number where Dietrich serenades the gang at the ranch with a little ditty that's aptly and ominously called Getaway Young Man. And so any fan of Blazing Saddles, and if you've never seen Destry Rides Alone, you will immediately recognize Madeline Kahn's uncanny impression of Dietrich's sonorous, husky delivery. But in the blink of an eye, during the sequence, almost before we can even perceive this transition, Long pulls the rug out from under us, and he changes the feeling from this perfunctory musical number to something that borders on the nightmarish, this claustrophobic unease which engulfs the viewer as we share in Kennedy's horror at what he perceives to be this banal cruelty of the people that he's shacking up with. And I think what makes Rancho Notorious such an intriguing little oddity is the way that Lang refuses to spare his own hero from ethically dubious actions. I mean, Kennedy in this film, he reminded me a lot of Glenn Ford in The Big Heat. And like Glenn Ford, Kennedy is this study of male rage that curdles over into this toxicity that allows him to commit real psychological, if not physical, violence against people who may not be entirely innocent, but they're certainly not outright villains either. And so in that way, the film is blurring this clear distinction between good and evil. And that moral ambivalence is certainly of a piece with other films that were coming out at that time, like Anthony Mann's The Naked Spur, or even, maybe most famously, John Ford's The Searchers. But while it may lack some of the sociopolitical verve of something like Johnny Guitar, or even The Searchers, which utilizes an anti-hero to explore these difficult questions or to unpack these difficult questions of America's violent colonialist past, what Rancho Notorious does is nevertheless provide this bold repudiation of the American West's mythic rendering of the male righteous hero. It utilizes the generic trappings of the Western to sneakily and, I would say, brutally dismantle these trappings one by one, so that by the end of this lean 89 minutes Western, none of the characters leave the film with a sense of their dignity or any sense of real righteous justice being served. If anything, Lang's acerbic tale can be broken down into the three basic components that the narrator sings over and over again, that what we are watching is a tale of murder, hate, and revenge. So really, Rancho Notorious is deceptively one of the most unsparingly bleak B-movie westerns that I've seen from the peak of the genre's popularity. And so if you like your western served up with a dash of acidity, absolutely check out Rancho Notorious. It's a nasty piece of work, and a nice little surprise, I would say.
You have my attention. but with Long, it's interesting how that acidity, I think, is there in a lot of his work. Like, it's, even if you just look at his American output, like, I think of not just The Big Heat and Human Desire, but also a movie that, I don't know if you saw, The Scarlet Street with Edward G. Robinson?
I did not, no.
It's a film that I don't think it was a great film, but it's like, it's one of those films, too, that I think taps into some of what you were talking about, of like, maybe characters being pushed to then doing these unspeakable, horrible things, and how... both the violent and psychological too. And I will say about Scarlet Street, it has like one of the most enjoyably dark endings I've ever seen to a film noir. It's a great ending. So, you know, hearing that, because I knew that with Rancho Notorious, I was looking up the critical reception, it seemed like not everyone was crazy about it. Like, the New York Times actually gave it a negative review upon release, but it sounds like it's got a bit going for it, and I would be interested.
The thing is, like, with filmmakers like Long, I mean, I think he's somebody who, like Max Ophuls and Douglas Sirk, these German filmmakers who emigrated to the United States, and they were able to work within the Hollywood system, and they did make what were perceived as films that conformed to the constraints of the genres they were working in. But you can sense a lot of their qualities and their personality in of course, All That Heaven Allows. And yeah, I think it's, and there's, but I think what makes, and I think, you know, Sirk could, and Ophuls could also be ironists as well. But I think Long had them both beat in terms of just how his irony could manifest in some very disarming and shocking ways. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth checking out. And if you're a Long fan, but if you haven't gotten into all of his Hollywood fare, or if you're someone who likes your Westerns, but you like them a little more in the vein of the anti-Westerns, or even something closer to the acid Western, it's definitely worth checking out.
I'll definitely try to check it out before it leaves the end of the month. I'll see if I can sneak it in, because I'm also watching some movies at the New York Film Festival this year from the comforts of home.
Well, we're going to have to talk about that in a forthcoming episode.
Yeah, I can't wait to share with you some of the movies I've seen, but I'll certainly try to give Rancho Notorious a look.
If you guys have seen any good films that are worth checking out, any recommendations you have, feel free to send them our way. We always love to be on the lookout for something to catch up on. If you have any Wuxia recommendations or any thoughts about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon's placement within that subgenre, definitely let us know what you think. Is it Ong Lee's best film? Is it one of his best, or is it overrated? Is there someone out there who's willing to be the one to really argue the case for Ride with the Devil as his masterwork? And I think you could make a really compelling case for that film. But in any case, let us know what you think. We'd love to hear it.
If you have a favorite also Wuxia film, like, have you seen any King Hu's classics, or do you have a favorite Michael Bay movie? Or I'm curious to know if Ong Lee, I wonder if there are any Gemini Man purists out there. I'm really curious to hear that.
And as always, thank you so much for taking yet another trip with us through film history. Be well, stay safe, and as always, continue watching great movies.
Thank you everyone for tuning in. Take care everyone. We're all in this together. Thank you.